guard is there. He makes a great show of keeping me out, but money changes hands, the gate is opened with a flourish, and I am on my way through an orchard of shriveled trees to get a better look at the three largest blocks ever used in any construction anywhere in the world. The highest pinnacle of power and science. In the 19th century, David Urquhart, a learned Scotsman, travelled widely in Lebanon, eventually publishing his history and diary in 1860. He never explained where he got the hint from, but it was his belief that Baalbek had played an important part in the secretive maritime empire of the Phoenicians, whose exploits started to be remarked upon by other cultures in the second millennium BC, and who were descended from the original Canaanite people of this region. Indeed, the Phoenicians usually referred to themselves as Canaanites. Renowned for their seafaring abilities, and especially for their uncanny, or perhaps one should say instead, precise and scientific navigational skills, they established ports all around the coasts of the Mediterranean as far afield as Tunisia, Morocco, Spain, Italy, Turkey, Cyprus, and Malta. Their heartland was in Lebanon, however, and their first city was Byblos, to the north of modern Beirut, with other important centres at Tyre and Sidon. There is much that is mysterious about the Phoenicians, and they have often been reproached by frustrated researchers for having been so persistently silent about themselves and for having left no written history of their own. Everything we know about them comes from the annals of other races, and they have only foreign advocates to plead their cause to posterity. One of those foreign advocates was the Greek scholar Philo, who lived in Byblos in the 1st and 2nd centuries AD. Hence he is known as Philo of Byblos. His Phoenician history purported to be a translation of a book written by one Sanchuniathon, a Phoenician sage who had supposedly lived more than 1,000 years earlier. Sanchuniathon's writings have not come down to us in any other source. Moreover, like the works of the Babylonian priest Berossos, whom the reader will recall from earlier chapters, Philo's own Phoenician history has also been lost. All that is left of it are fragments preserved as quotations and summaries by other authors, notably the 4th century church father Eusebius. In these fragments we read of the exploits of a god, identified with the Greek deity Uranos, whose name means sky or heaven, and who invented betils by devising stones endowed with life. There are a couple of points of interest here. First of all, obviously, we are back in the realm of betils, those meteoritic stones fallen from heaven that are so often part of the debris stream of fragmenting comets, and that were treated as cult objects throughout the ancient Near East. If we look into the etymology of the word betil, we find that it means home of the god, and the home of Uranos is, of course, the sky, the right place for objects of meteoritic origin. Secondly, there is this curious reference to stones endowed with life, which significantly is given in some translations as stones that moved as having life. In this, I couldn't help but be reminded of traditions from ancient Egypt that spoke of huge stones being effortlessly moved around by magicians using words of power. For example, there is an account, preserved on British Museum Papyrus No. 604, of the deeds of the magician Horus the Nubian, who made a vault of stone 200 cubits long and 50 cubits wide rise above the head of Pharaoh and his nobles. When Pharaoh looked up at the sky, he opened his mouth in a great cry, together with the people who were in the court. Since 200 cubits by 50 cubits equates to approximately 100 meters by 25 meters, 328 feet by 82 feet, it is obvious that any magician who could raise such a massive block would have no difficulty raising the megaliths of the Trilithon, which are less than a quarter of that size. At any rate, this thought of the magicians of the gods brings us back by a circuitous route to David Urquhart, who tells us in his history and diary what it was that led him to Baalbek in the mid-19th century. I was drawn thither by the Bettelia, the Bettils, that mystery of the ancient writers, which I believe to have been magnets used in the Phoenician vessels engaged in distant traffic, and which on return of their fleets were conveyed in religious procession to the temple at Baalbek, to remain there until the fleets were again sent forth. Unfortunately, Urquhart found no hints of the lost technology, the magical magnetic stones he was looking for in Baalbek. "Where is the temple that held the Bettelia?" he asked. "It has disappeared." He deduced that it must have stood upon the platform and was probably pulled down to make way for the Roman temples. He therefore contented himself with an inquiry into the mysteries of the Trilithon and of an even larger cutstone block that his local informants showed him lying abandoned in the quarry half a mile to the south of the ruins. These ruins, he noted, when you imagine them without the later temples now stuck on the top, were nothing but a quadrangular enclosure. One can't conceive the hewing out of enormous blocks for the statue of a king, the ornament of a palace, or the pomp of a temple, but here there is no such object, there is no conceivable object by which such an effort can be explained. This was one of a series of questions to which Urquhart could propose no answers of his own. First, why build with such huge blocks, beside which Stonehenge is a nursery toy? Second, why build here, since Baalbek was not a great capital or a great port, but stood far inland? Third, why was the work suddenly stopped, as evidenced by the block in the quarry, and by the unfinished state of the U-shaped wall in which the Trilithon is set? And fourth, why was Baalbek unique? This structure is alone, Urquhart noted. There is nothing upon earth in the remotest degree resembling it. That night, Urquhart dined with the emir of Baalbek and asked him whom the huge U-shaped enclosure had been built by. The emir replied in rather matter-of-fact tones that there had been three phases of construction. The megalithic work had been done at the command of two different rulers in the primeval period before the flood. And then came the deluge. After that it was repaired by Solomon. When he was on his way back to Beirut, Urquhart reflected on what the emir had told him, concluding that it touched on a fundamental truth, and that the stones of Baalbek had to be considered as some of those sturdy fellows who the deluge could not sweep away. More than that, it seemed to him that before the deluge, the whole course of human society had been run. The builders of Baalbek must have been a people who had attained to the highest pinnacle of power and science, and this region must have been at the center of their domain. Noah, after all, had mastered the science to build the ark. A vessel, Urquhart pointed out, 450 feet long, 75 broad, and 45 deep. He therefore shared in the knowledge of these men of renown, and navigation must have attained in those antediluvian times to an extraordinary degree of perfection. For the building of the ark we have only the authority of the Bible. The skeptic, on the other hand, who visits Baalbek, will cease to doubt that the men who could build into its walls stones of the weight of a three-decker with its guns on board could construct a vessel of such immense dimensions. I assume that the antediluvian origin of the one can no more be contested by the critic than that of the other by the believer. Today, and rightly so, skeptics question everything that smacks of credulous superstition and easy belief. The traditions that so excited Urquhart, however, are pervasive. Noah himself is said to be buried in the area, having returned there after the flood, to live out the remainder of his days. And according to Estefan el-Douahi, Maronite patriarch of Lebanon from 1670 to 1704, Baalbek is the most ancient building in the world. It was peopled with giants who were punished for their iniquities by the flood. Other traditions implicate demons in the placing of the megaliths, and an Arabic manuscript echoes the story Urquhart was told about an attempt to rebuild Baalbek after the flood. In this account, it was not Solomon, but Nimrod, the great-grandson of Noah, who sent giants to repair the damaged walls. Demons, giants, rollers, capstans, cranes, or aliens? Looking up at the three massive blocks of the Trilithon, their base is more than 6 meters, 20 feet above ground level in Baalbek's western wall, I can understand why they were believed to be the work of demons or giants. There is indeed something supernatural, something seemingly impossible about them. Their lengths are respectively 19.60 meters, 64 feet, 3 inches, 19.30 meters, 63 feet, 3 inches, and 19.10 meters, 62 feet, 8 inches. And they're all 4.34 meters, 14 feet, 3 inches high, and 3.65 meters, just a shade under 12 feet wide. They are fitted in place so precisely that it is impossible to insert even the edge of a razor blade into the joints. Go figure, is all I can say. But if you want the orthodox take on the subject, read Jean-Pierre Adam's 1977 paper A propos du Trilithon de Baalbek, Le transport et la mise en œuvre des mégaliths. It's still the standard work of reference cited by all skeptics as though it proves their case, and it sets out a proposal deploying rollers of cedar wood on which we are to envisage the blocks being placed. To pull the blocks over the rollers, Adam first considers, then, for logistical reasons, rejects the use of a herd of 800 oxen. Finally, reasoning that weakness of human muscle power can be overcome by technical ingenuity, he settles on multiple arrays of pulleys, rigged up to 6 capstans, each worked by a team of 24 men, making a total of just 144 men, to transport the blocks of the Trilithon one by one from the quarry half a mile, 800 meters away, to the construction site. At the end of the journey, he calculates that 16 larger capstans, each worked by a team of 32 men, in other words, 512 men in total, would have been required to maneuver the blocks into their final position. The reason for the increased number of capstans and men at the end of the operation is that the wooden rollers would have to be removed, since obviously they could not be left in place in the wall. This would greatly increase the friction between the block and the surface over which it had to be dragged, but the deployment of some kind of lubricant would theoretically reduce the friction enough to avoid any need to lift the blocks, a problem that Adam believes the Romans would have preferred not to confront with blocks of this size. Friedrich Raget has a slightly different orthodox solution to the challenge of moving and placing the megaliths of the Trilithon. In his case, it does involve lifting the blocks at the end of the procedure, which he suggests would have been done using multiple Lewis devices, metal pieces fitted into specially cut holes in the stones above their center of mass, attached to chains or ropes, and lifted by cranes or winches. The 800-ton block of the Trilithon, says Raget, must have been moved into position by rollers. Then it had to be lifted slightly to allow the removal of the rollers before the tremendous load was lowered inch by inch. If we figure 5 tons lifting capacity per Lewis hole, we would need 160 attachments to the stone. It's not my intention to offer a detailed critique here. I simply note in passing that there are some difficulties with Adam's and Raget's proposals. Both, for example, rely on wooden rollers, but calculations indicate that the stress of supporting the huge blocks would very quickly have crushed such rollers, even if they were cut from the strongest Lebanon cedar. Likewise, capstans are all very well, and certainly multiply the muscle power that each man is able to exert, but there is a danger, which Adam recognizes, that unless massively anchored to the ground, it would be the capstans rather than the blocks that moved. Finally, every mason understands the principle of Lewis devices and how they work, but there is no sign on the trilithon blocks of even a single Lewis hole, let alone of 160 on each of them. Both Adam and Raguette and others who want to reassure us how unremarkable and unmysterious the whole achievement of the trilithon is, like to preface their accounts with reference to large megaliths that were moved using known technologies in historical times. For example, a 25-meter, 82-feet-tall Egyptian obelisk weighing 320 tons was brought to Rome in the 1st century AD by the Emperor Caligula. Transporting it from Egypt and across the Mediterranean in a specially built ship was itself an incredible feat of engineering, logistics, and heavy lifting. Then, much later, in the 16th century, the same obelisk was moved from where it had stood since Caligula's time and re-erected in St. Peter's Square on the orders of Pope Sixtus V. Likewise in Russia, in the late 18th century, the Thunderstone, a 1,250-ton block of granite, the base for an equestrian statue of Peter the Great that still stands in the city of St. Petersburg, was hauled 7 kilometers overland on a special movable track of bronze spheres. Mind you, it's one thing to drag a supersized megalith in a straight line over bronze ball bearings, or to stand one up in the middle of a huge empty square, but it's quite another to build a series of such megaliths into a wall that looks like a Titan's Lego project. Still, let's accept that it can be done, that similar things have been done, and of course, for the evidence is before our eyes, that it was done at Baalbek. The only question that matters, therefore, is whether it was the Romans who did it, or whether they and the cultures that preceded them here going back 10,000 years or more found the U-shaped megalithic wall already in place and fitted their own structures into its embrace. That's what it looks like to me. The solid foundation rising above the plain at Baalbek that Daniel Lohmann identifies as pre-Roman and calls Podium 1, and on top of which the Temple of Jupiter was built, sits nicely inside the U-shaped wall, which embraces it on its south, west, and northern sides. At no point does the wall support the Temple of Jupiter. It is an entirely separate exterior structure. I walk several times along the western wall, gazing up in stupefaction at the awesome megaliths of the Trilithon, trying to get to grips with what they mean. Regardless of whether it was the Romans or some unknown antediluvian culture who put them here, what I'd like to know is why they put them 20 feet up. Why did they stack them on top of courses of smaller blocks, when surely the logic would have been to put the largest, heaviest blocks at ground level and add the smaller, lighter blocks above them? Why create the huge additional engineering and lifting challenge of doing it the other way round? I walk along the wall. I'm counting blocks and courses. First of all, working upwards from ground level, there are 3 courses of really quite small, let's say 1.5 meters high, quarter-ton ashlars. On top of these are 6 much bigger blocks, very nicely finished, although also very heavily eroded, with the upper half trimmed in to be narrower than the base. These 6 blocks, which are more or less identical to blocks in the south wall that I described in the previous chapter, weigh about 400 tons each. Finally, on top of them, come the 3 monster 800-ton blocks of the Trilithon. I walk north now, to the corner of the west and the north walls. The northernmost block of the Trilithon doesn't extend right to the end of the west wall. There's a gap, filled up by an Arab defensive tower extending from Podium 1 and built over the corner. But if I remove that tower in my mind's eye, then I can see what's going on, because on the other side of it is another huge row of megaliths forming the northern arm of the U-shaped wall, the row that I'd looked down on earlier from above. Indeed, the Arab defensive tower was the very one I stepped out on to get a proper view of this part of the megalithic wall, which is separated by a grassy gap 35 feet wide from the north wall of Podium 1. I know archaeologists see the U-shaped wall as the base of the Temple of Jupiter's grandiose but unfinished Podium 2. Lohmann makes a very good case for it being exactly that. But I'm still bothered by its non-load-bearing, purely cosmetic function if that's the case, and I can't shake the feeling that it was a feature the Romans inherited from a much earlier time. Where I do agree with the archaeologists, however, is that the even larger megaliths that I know are still in the quarry half a mile away, and that I'm going to take a look at as soon as I'm finished here, were definitely intended to sit on top of the northern and southern arms of the U-shaped wall, thus raising them to the height that the western wall attained with the placement of the trilithon. True, they're a bit longer and wider than the trilithon blocks, but after trimming off the boss left to protect them on their journey from the quarry, they would match exactly, fitting like the pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. This remains the case, whether the Romans made the U-shaped wall as part of Podium 2, or whether it was the work of the architects and masons of a lost civilization of prehistoric antiquity. And there's something else I agree with the archaeologists on. Ideas put into circulation decades ago by ancient astronaut enthusiasts, notably Zechariah Sitchin in his book Stairway to Heaven, first published in 1980, and in other later volumes of his Earth Chronicles series, cannot possibly be right. Whatever Baalbek is, and for whatever reason megaliths of 800 tons and more were used here, and whoever it was who put those megaliths in place, they definitely did not do so in order to create a landing place for the aircraft of the gods. Sitchin's claim that the raised platform of Baalbek was intended to support some extremely heavy weight, and that the heavy weight in question was a rocket-like flying chamber, could only have been made by a man who had no idea of the real appearance and layout of Baalbek itself, and could only be believed by others with no direct knowledge of the site. The giant megalithic blocks of the trilithon that seemed to have convinced Sitchin the entire platform of Baalbek was megalithic all turn out to be parts of the U-shaped wall that embraces the only modestly sized Podium 1. And while an alien might conceivably land his spacecraft on even so modest a podium, if there were no other structure there, he certainly would not want to land it on top of a wall. It follows, therefore, that to use the megalithic character of the U-shaped wall to claim that a podium, which it is not even connected to and does not support, was an alien landing platform designed to bear extremely heavy weights where all landings and takeoffs of the shuttlecraft had to be conducted, is either ignorant or disingenuous or both. Besides, even if the whole of the Baalbek complex was megalithic, which is not at all the case, we must ask ourselves why technologically advanced aliens, capable of crossing the solar system in their spaceships, would need such a platform to land on in the first place. If they could hop from planet to planet, as Sitchin asks us to believe, wouldn't their science be up to constructing something a little more high-tech and fit for purpose than that? In short, isn't it obvious that Sitchin simply took 1970s NASA space technology as his template and projected it onto his imagined ancient astronauts? I knew Zechariah Sitchin personally, had a few dinners with him in New York, and once drove him from Stonehenge to London when he was on a visit to England. I liked him well enough, and I think he did some good research, but on Baalbek at least I have no doubt now, after exploring the site myself, that his whole landing platform thesis is fundamentally flawed. This is not to say, however, that every idea set out in his books was equally compromised. The Mesopotamian cuneiform texts, which he could not read and translate as he claimed, his translations were adapted and to some extent fictionalized from the work of mainstream scholars, do in fact contain material of the greatest interest, and I think he was right to notice hints of high technology in them. But were those technologies alien or human? This is a question we'll return to in Chapter 16 when we'll consider what is known about certain powerful beings referred to in biblical and other ancient texts as the Nephilim and the Watchers. The biggest cut stone block in the world. I have found that archaeologists are seldom receptive to the notion of ancient astronauts, wrote Elif Batuman in an article about Baalbek in the New Yorker on the 18th of December 2014. Although one could argue that when the archaeologists went looking for answers, all they managed to find was an even bigger and more mysterious block. Indeed so. In June 2014, just a month before I arrived in Baalbek, the German Archaeological Institute made a stunning discovery in the quarries half a mile south of the Temple of Jupiter. There, it had long been known, lay two giant megaliths that are heavier by a significant margin than any of the stones in the Trilithon. What no one had suspected, however, despite a century of rather intensive investigations around Baalbek, was that a third immense block lay buried and hidden from view under the sediment that has accumulated in the quarry over the millennia. The archaeologists chose not to announce their discovery to the world until late November 2014, but since they had excavated it in June, it lay there in full view when I first visited the quarry on the 10th of July, and a local shopkeeper, who claimed that the discovery was in fact his and that the Germans had merely appropriated it, made a point of drawing it to my attention. The quarry is in two parts, divided by a road, and in the first area you come to as you approach from the direction of the temples lies the famous Stone of the Pregnant Woman, also known as the Stone of the South, which has been decorating postcards from Baalbek for 100 years, and was known to travellers like David Urquhart long before that. It measures 21.50 metres, almost 71 feet in length, 4.20 metres, just under 14 feet in height, and 4.30 metres, just over 14 feet in width. It weighs 970 tons. Across the road, a second, even bigger megalith, which had lain undiscovered since time immemorial, was unearthed in the 1990s. It measures 20.5 metres in length, 4.56 metres wide, and 4.5 metres high. Its weight has been calculated to be 1,242 tonnes. But the megalith that was discovered in June 2014 has a mass greater than either of these, measuring 19.60 metres, 64 feet 4 inches long, 6 metres, 19 feet 9 inches wide, and 5.5 metres, 18 feet high, with an estimated weight of 1,650 tonnes. It was this newly excavated megalith, the single largest block of stone ever quarried in the ancient world, that the excited shopkeeper proudly pointed out to me during my visit. Its upper surface is less than 2 meters below the lower edge of the Stone of the Pregnant Woman, which it lies immediately beside and parallel to. And like the Stone of the Pregnant Woman, it is beautifully cut and shaped, ready, after removal of the boss, to go straight into the U-shaped wall for which all three giant blocks were undoubtedly intended. I spend some hours clambering around these weird, otherworldly blocks. I feel as though I'm mountaineering. The scale is so immense, and in a way so alien, that a curious detachment from everyday reality sets in, and I lose all track of time. I note that the Stone of the Pregnant Woman appears to have been sliced through at the base, where it emerges from the bedrock with a clean, straight cut. How was that done? And no matter where I stand, above, below, beside, I am dwarfed by this monstrous product of ancient and unknowable minds. The very thought that someone, in some distant epoch, could conceive of this, could cut it out and shape it entire, and then at the end just leave it here, abandon it, forget about it, is incomprehensible to me. The closer I examine it, the more details I observe of the precision of the workmanship, of the scale of the enterprise, and of the will and imagination that went into its creation, the more certain I become that it and its fellows here in the quarries, and the Trilithon, and the other giant megaliths of Baalbek were not the work of the Romans. I know how profoundly Daniel Lohmann disagrees. A few months later, in February 2015, he and I will correspond at some length over several days. He will graciously answer many questions and help me to understand some of the complexities of Baalbek that escaped me when I was there. he'll make an excellent case for the Roman provenance of the whole vast scheme. He will even send me a photograph of the column drum built into the foundations of the Trilithon wall, and he'll write, "In my recent work, I located this column drum fragment, excavated it anew, and measured it millimeter precise to determine the drum diameter. I looked at the surface structure and mason's dressing in comparison with the Jupiter temple columns and the lithology. All indications are exactly the same as the column drums of the Roman Jupiter temple. The fragment was neatly dressed at the edges to make a masonry ashlar out of it. And it received the beautifully sharply cut edges that all ashlars of the Roman Jupiter temple phase have, including the megaliths." My reply. First of all, to be absolutely clear, I don't dispute that this fragment is from a column drum of the Roman Jupiter temple. Clearly it is. And I don't dispute the generally agreed dating of the columns of the Roman Jupiter temple. But this fragment is a very important part of the formidable edifice of logic you and your colleagues used to establish the chronology of the Trilithon, and that many others have relied upon when reporting that chronology. What I'd like to interrogate a little further, therefore, is your level of certainty that this column drum fragment was put there at the same time as the original construction of the Western Wall. It's nicely cut and shaped, I agree, but still it sticks out like a sore thumb. Especially now I see it cleared in the photo you kindly sent me. It looks intrusive, odd, and awkward, very different from the rest of the blocks in this course. In short, I think the argument can be made that it is more likely to be a later repair of the wall than it is to be an integral part of the original wall. Lending some support to this argument is that we know the Arabs were constantly repairing the walls around the whole site, and sometimes using column drums to do so. So why shouldn't this be just one more of those repairs? What is the absolutely compelling archaeological evidence that completely, effectively, and once and for all rules this possibility out? I'd be most grateful if you could address that specific point in your reply. Lohmann comes right back to me on this. The fragment is just one of the indications that shows the synchronicity of the megalith podium and the temple, which was not our result, but known to science for over 100 years, and at latest since the excavations by the German team of 1900 to 1904. Yes, it sticks out, but no, not unlike the others, the builders of the temple were rather pragmatic. Once the structure was to be hidden underneath the soil or behind something else, they didn't bother to flatten the surfaces or make it look nice. What was important first when building is that the ashlar was perfectly flattened on the top and bottom, and then the two sides, in order to create a solid and stable wall. And that was done on the column drum, exactly in the same Roman manner as it was done on the blocks around it. If you look at the length of the fragment and imagine a hole in the wall instead, the two smaller ashlars in the course above would fall, causing further instability for the structures above. Here, frictional connection, force closure, translations of Kraftschluss from my dictionary, language barriers, is needed. You can't just replace an ashlar in a row of stretchers. Secondly, Arab repairs of Roman walls look a lot different. They used smaller blocks instead and would never have been able to squeeze a block in so tightly. Medieval repairs never have such tight joints. It's a comparison of precision that makes an engineer like me 100% certain. After examining our own photographs of the Trilithon wall, Santa took a great many while we were there, I find myself unpersuaded by Lohmann's argument. First of all, this column drum is not hidden underneath soil or behind something else. It's in plain view, in the lowest visible course of the wall, and it does stick out like a sore thumb. It's made of a distinctively different, much darker stone, and it has a very different look from any neighboring block. It is quite unique, in fact. Secondly, as to precision, I don't agree with Lohmann that the column drum cannot be an Arab repair. In plates 42 and 43, the reader will find an example of another column drum, which is certainly part of an Arab repair to the walls of Baalbek, and its precision is as good as that on the column drum in the foundations. Another possibility I've considered, that it could be a Roman repair to a pre-Roman wall, also remains very much in play. If the lower block, which this improvised block replaced, had been badly damaged, and a decision had been made to remove it, the two small rectangular blocks above it, the ones Lohmann said would fall, causing further instability for the structures above, would have had to be removed at the same time. But the next course up is so set that none of the other blocks in it would have fallen, nor would any instability have been caused to the huge megalith in the course above that, which is supported on no less than 5 large horizontal blocks, 3 of which would be entirely unaffected by the removal of the 2 smaller blocks below, while the other 2 would have been held in place by frictional connection. Once the column drum had been cut to shape and put in place at ground level, the 2 smaller blocks could have been slid back into the wall above it, completing a very neat and effective repair. There's something else, a fundamental area of disagreement, concerning what I see as a U-shaped megalithic wall surrounding Podium 1, but that Lohmann sees as the first courses of Podium 2. He tells me that aside from the size of the ashlars, what I call a U-shaped megalithic wall is the bottom of a standard shape of a Roman temple podium after Augustus times. He asks me to take a look at the podium of the Maison Carrée in Nîmes and suggests that the temple of Bacchus in Baalbek itself also has a similar podium. He sends me links to photographs. If you zoom in, he writes, you can see the stones of the second layer above the bottom layer, corresponding to the trilithon. My reply: you write that the megalithic podium for the Temple of Jupiter, though obviously on a very different scale, is the standard shape of a Roman temple podium, but I'm not sure I see that from the pics you've linked to. I attach here one of ours from the Temple of Bacchus, same angle as the one you sent. It shows a podium with a single straight side, apart from the lip at top and bottom, whereas the podium of the Temple of Jupiter gives more of a stepped effect, with the row of huge megalithic blocks that, according to our correspondence, form part of the lowest layer of the Julio-Claudian temple podium, stepped out very far from the sheer wall above them, on top of which stood the peristasis. I suppose the resemblance would be better if the megalithic layer had been completed and extended all the way up to the top of the wall, but the peristasis would still have been set back a few meters from the top, instead of pretty much flush with the top, as it is in the Temple of Bacchus. In short, when I zoom in to the Temple of Bacchus podium, I don't really see blocks, regardless of scale, that correspond with the trilithon blocks. Am I missing something obvious here? I also ask, have you found organic materials with good provenance anywhere in Podium 2, and have you done carbon dating on these? On the carbon dating, Lohmann replies that, unfortunately, none had been done. The history of constant change in the building, he says, as well as deep excavation levels of the past 100 years, have left no archaeological or organic material at all that would help us with this. In its own way, this is quite a revelation to me, since it means, to deploy an appropriate metaphor, that the entire edifice of archaeological chronology for the so-called Julio-Claudian podium, Podium 2 of the Temple of Jupiter, rests on foundations in which there is no scientific dating evidence whatsoever. This is not to say that radiocarbon dates for archaeological sites are unproblematic. As we've seen in earlier chapters, they are often very problematic indeed, unless it can be demonstrated, as is the case at Göbekli Tepe, that the dated organic remains have been sealed at a particular moment and there is no possibility of subsequent intrusion of later materials that might give a falsely young date. But there are simply no carbon dates, problematic or not, for Podium 2. It follows, therefore, that the orthodox chronology of this incredibly interesting and peculiar structure is based entirely on stylistic factors, that certain styles of building can be associated with specific cultures and specific periods, and that the style seen in Podium 2 is entirely appropriate to the Julio-Claudian epoch of Roman construction. It's my view that the stylistic argument at Baalbek is nowhere near as clear-cut as it should be, given how much of our understanding of the site depends on it. And in response to my question about the positioning of the peristasis, in other words, of the four-sided porch or hall of columns surrounding the cella, the inner building of the temple, Lohmann admits there is a stylistic anomaly. Yes, Normally, the peristasis would rest on the edge of the podium, as it does at the Bacchus Temple. That would be following the Roman examples. Mars Ultor at the Roman Forum was a milestone building for that. It is one of the oddities of Jupiter. On the other hand, Lohmann points out, temples do exist where the peristasis is set back in the way he envisages it would ultimately have been at Baalbek if Podium 2 had ever been completed. For example, the Bel Temple in Palmyra, the Temple of Zeus in Izanoi, Turkey, and the colossal Temple of Tarsus, Turkey. In my opinion, he writes, this is due to the fact that both Bel Temple and Jupiter in Baalbek were built onto older podia, Herodian in Baalbek, Hellenistic in Palmyra, and had to find a solution how to squeeze a first-century latest-fashion Roman podium underneath the even only slightly older temple building. Baalbek's terrace was immensely high, so the podium needed to be colossal, and in Palmyra, the peristasis was already standing, so the podium was erected at a distance. Further, Lohmann stands his ground on the issue of the shape of Podium 2, which, despite its incompleteness, he sees as being quite normal. A standard podium, he writes, consists of a bottom profile, lip as you call it, the shaft or the vertical part, that's the trilithon layer in Baalbek, and a top lip layer. He attaches an architectural diagram of the podium of Hossen Niha, another Roman temple in Lebanon, to make his point. To my eye, however, it looks astonishingly unlike Podium 2 at Baalbek, and the layer in it that he wants me to compare to the trilithon is just 1.58 meters, 5 feet 3 inches high, whereas the trilithon, as we've seen, is 4.34 meters, 14 feet 3 inches high. As I've already noted, I think Daniel Lohmann makes a strong case. But nothing in our correspondence proves to me that the U-shaped megalithic wall that surrounds but does not support Podium 1 on which the Temple of Jupiter in fact stands is the work of the Romans. He could be right, but he could also be wrong, and in context of all the other indications from around the world of a lost civilization, I think it wise to keep an open mind on Baalbek. Finally, however, it's what I see in the quarry that convinces me of this. Because we have to ask ourselves why three huge blocks in the range of 1,000 to 1,650 tons were left there at all. The conventional answer is that the Romans, having quarried these exceptionally large blocks, found that they could not move them and simply abandoned them. But that explanation makes very little sense. If the argument that the Romans were responsible for the U-shaped megalithic wall is correct, then we know that they went on to build an extensive temple complex dedicated to Jupiter using smaller blocks of stone. Surely their first source for the multiple smaller blocks they needed would have been the huge megaliths that, according to the argument of mainstream archaeology, they had discovered they could not move from the quarry. The Romans were practical people who would not allow work that they had already so painstakingly done to go to waste. Rather than opening up fresh quarry faces, wouldn't they have used those massive, already almost completely quarried, 1,000-ton-plus blocks and simply sliced them up into smaller, more movable megaliths for the construction of the rest of the temple? It's really puzzling that they didn't do so. And therefore the fact that these gigantic, almost finished blocks remain in the quarry and were never sliced up into smaller blocks and used in the general construction of the Temple of Jupiter suggests to me very strongly that the Romans did not even know they were there. Just as the German Archaeological Institute, despite 100 years of excavations, didn't know until 2014 that a third massive block was there. In due course, I'm told, good new information about the dating and practicalities of the quarry megaliths may be forthcoming, but that information was not available at the time of writing. I await it with interest, but also with some doubt as to whether it will settle anything or simply raise further questions. We are a species with amnesia. The devastating comet impacts that set the Younger Dryas in train 12,800 years ago, and that caused two episodes of global flooding, one at the beginning and one at the end of the Younger Dryas, made us forget so much. The recovery of memory from the fragments that remain is logistically difficult and psychologically painful, as the complexities and decades of disputes around Baalbek show. but the messages still reach us from the deep and distant past in the words of the sages, in the deeds of the magicians, and in the mighty memorials that they left behind to awaken us at the time of the Great Return. Part 6. Stars. Chapter 14. The Gates of the Sun. Baalbek remains very much on my mind the next day as we drive the magnificent coastline around Junia Bay, heading 38 kilometers north to Byblos, the ancient Phoenician port that claims, with some justification, to be the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world. Archaeologists have established that it was occupied as early as 8,800 BC, while Göbekli Tepe still functioned. By 5,000 BC, Byblos was a flourishing, stable settlement that has never since been without human population. By 3000 BC, when it was known as Gubla or Gebel, it had grown to become the key port and city of the ancient Canaanite coast. It was the Greeks who later called it Byblos, when it served as the center of a lucrative papyrus trade with Egypt. Byblos is the Greek word for papyrus. Likewise, the reader will recall from chapter 13 that Phoenician was the Greek name for the Canaanites, and that the Phoenicians referred to themselves as Canaanites. For simplicity's sake, I will continue to use the terms Phoenician and Canaanite interchangeably here, and continue to refer to ancient Gubla Gebel as Byblos. As we pull into Byblos with its street cafes and palms and the bright Mediterranean lapping at its beautiful crescent-shaped harbour, what's on my mind about Baalbek is a question. Why didn't the Romans choose to build the greatest and most spectacular temple in their entire empire? In Rome itself. Or failing that, if for some reason they felt compelled to build the Temple of Jupiter in Lebanon, then why didn't they build it in a prestigious and important entrepot like Byblos? And if not in Byblos, then why not in another of the renowned Phoenician ports along the same coast, such as Tyre or Sidon? Why Baalbek for the Temple of Jupiter? That's the question. But there's no easy answer, because archaeologists and historians admit that not a single shred of evidence exists to tell us who commissioned, paid for, or designed any portion of the complex. We can therefore only speculate as to their motives. It is really rather surprising when you consider the scale of the enterprise that no emperor, no general, and no architect ever claimed credit for it. But the fact is that the temple remained peculiarly absent from the annals of the Romans and of all other peoples for many centuries after it was built. Not until Macrobius, who wrote in the 5th century AD, by which time Baalbek had long been Christianized, do we even get a reference to the god who was worshipped there. It is almost as though a spell of silence was cast over the place by the magicians of a former age, and that the Romans fell under its glamour, allowing themselves to be bound by it, even as they raised up the huge columns and pediments of their own temples. In consequence, as architectural historian Del Upton observes, ancient Baalbek is a figment of our imaginations. Even the site itself, as we see it now, is in a sense a work of fantasy, since so much of it, as Upton points out, was reconstructed by a German archaeological mission in the early 20th century and by French and Lebanese archaeologists in the 1930s, 1950s, and 1960s. The rest we know from reconstruction drawings of the complex in a mythical state of completion. It is a continuation of this archaeological myth-making, I believe, that leads Daniel Lohmann to his paradoxical speculation that the builders of Roman Baalbek were megalomaniacs, even though they were, in fact, so self-effacing that they never sought to associate themselves by name with any of the giant strides towards monumentality that they took there. The most gigantic of all these megalomaniac strides, of course, if Lohmann is right, was the unfinished attempt to give the Temple of Jupiter a purely cosmetic, non-load-bearing podium, rising, had it ever been completed, to around 50 feet high, dwarfing any other Roman temple podium, and made up of blocks weighing hundreds of tons, and in the case of the Trilithon, close to 1,000 tons. In Lohmann's reference frame, and the reference frame of every archaeologist for the past century, only megalomaniacs would contemplate such a task. Since we're all speculating, however, I offer the alternative speculation that the Romans chose Baalbek for the Temple of Jupiter, that it was such a special place to them, precisely because the U-shaped wall that Lohmann thinks was the base of their megalomaniac podium was already there, coming down from the time of the gods themselves, and worthy of veneration in later ages, purely in order to honour those ancient gods, rather than to exalt the names and stoke the egos of those who honoured them. Star Worshippers. Overlooking the ruins of Phoenician and Roman temples, a castle from the Crusader period, 12th century AD, is the dominant landmark in Byblos today. And interestingly, this Crusader castle, reconstructed and repaired many times, has at least a dozen Roman column drums reused as masonry blocks in its walls, a reminder that in this region you can never take any piece of architecture entirely at face value. But the castle is a wonderful spot to get a sense of the old, indeed the truly ancient city of Byblos, from which Phoenician seafarers once sailed out to all points of the known world and beyond. For the suggestion that the Phoenicians reached the Americas thousands of years before Columbus continues to be supported by intriguing, though fragmentary, evidence. There is also a mysterious connection with ancient Egypt that goes far beyond the papyrus trade between these two ancient peoples. This connection concerns the god Osiris, whose celestial image the ancient Egyptians saw in the constellation of Orion. The father of Horus and the husband of Isis, the goddess of magic, Osiris was, according to tradition, a great king of primordial times, who offered the gifts of civilization to those who were willing to receive them. After weaning the indigenous peoples of Egypt from their miserable and barbarous manners, he taught them how to till the earth and how to sow and reap crops. He formulated a code of laws for them and made them worship the gods and perform service to them. He then left Egypt and travelled over the rest of the world, teaching the various nations to do what his own subjects were doing. He forced no man to carry out his instructions, but by means of gentle persuasion and an appeal to their reason, he succeeded in inducing them to practice what he preached. The deeds of this great civilizing teacher, as they are recorded in the ancient Egyptian annals, are, of course, reminiscent of the mission of those companies of gods, magicians, and sages whom the Edfu building texts tell us wandered the earth in their great ships after the flood that destroyed their homeland, seeking to bring about the resurrection of the antediluvian world. And the antagonist Set, who appears in the Edfu tradition and is eventually defeated and subdued by Horus, also plays a key role in the Osiris cycle of myths. He plots against the god-king while he's away on his civilizing mission, and on his return, he contrives to murder him with the help, significantly, of 72 co-conspirators. There is code here, for as the reader will recall, the number 72 is the heartbeat of the precessional cycle, the number of years required for one degree of precessional motion. The body of Osiris, we are told, is placed in a sarcophagus by Set and the other conspirators and thrown in the Nile, whence the current carries it north and out into the Mediterranean Sea. The waves carried the box to the coast of Lebanon and cast it up at Byblos, and as soon as it rested on the ground, a large tree sprang up, and growing all around the box, enclosed it on every side. The king of Byblos marvelled at the size of this tree, and had it cut down and caused a pillar for his palace to be made of that portion of the trunk which contained the box. Discovering the whereabouts of her husband's remains, Isis takes ship to Byblos, goes to the palace, and contrives to have herself appointed as nursemaid to the children of the king. When unobserved, she transforms into a swallow and flies round and round the pillar lamenting. Eventually, she reveals her true identity and persuades the monarch to give her the pillar, from which she removes the sarcophagus containing the dead body of Osiris and returns with it to Egypt. What happens next is a long story that we needn't go into here, but the upshot is the resurrection of Osiris in the heavens as the constellation of Orion, where, as a star god, he reigns over the afterlife kingdom, his consort Isis by his side, in the form of the bright star Sirius, called Soptu or Sept in the ancient Egyptian language, often rendered in Greek as Sothis. In one text, which makes these stellar identifications particularly clear, Isis speaks of Osiris as follows: "Thy sacred image, Orion in heaven, rises and sets every day. I am Sothis, following after him, and I will not forsake him." And in the pyramid texts, we read among many similar utterances that Osiris has come as Orion. Multiple other references also identify deceased pharaohs of Egypt with Osiris and with the stars of Orion and Sirius. For example, "O flesh of the king, do not decay. You shall reach the sky as Orion. Your soul shall be as effective as Sothis." Likewise, "O king, the sky conceives you with Orion. The dawn light bears you with Orion. He who lives, lives by the command of the gods, and you live. You will regularly ascend with Orion from the eastern region of the sky. You will regularly descend with Orion into the western region of the sky." From such texts, notes Egyptologist Salim Hassan, "I think it cannot possibly be denied that at one period in their history, the Egyptians believed that the souls of their kings either mingled with the stars or became a star, and this tradition never entirely died out. Moreover, the association of the Giza pyramids with the stellar cult was long maintained by tradition, and those of Khufu and Khafre retained the reputation of being connected with star worship at least as late as the Arab period." In the same passage, Hassan then goes on to make an observation of the greatest relevance to my research. In the Geographical Dictionary, Mogam al-Budan, by Yakut al-Hamawi, he writes, volume 8, page 457, Cairo edition, "It is said, after giving the dimensions of the two largest of the Giza pyramids, to both of them the Sabians made their pilgrimage." Now, of course, Hassan points out, these Sabians were star worshippers, and if I guess rightly, they had derived their name from the Egyptian word spa, star. The Sabians were followers of an ancient religion, worshippers of the host of heaven, the heavenly bodies. Whatever the origin of their name may have been, the fact remains that they fully recognized the pyramids of Khufu and Khafre as being monuments connected with the stellar cult, and revered them as places of pilgrimage. The connection Hassan makes here is a remarkable one, because the home city of the Sabians, since time immemorial, was Harran, in southeastern Turkey, within a few miles of Göbekli Tepe. Moreover, as well as being star worshippers, these Sabians of Harran were followers of the books of Thoth, in which the ancient Egyptian wisdom god had set down the words of the sages. Indeed, in Islamic times, for hundreds of years after the revelation of the Quran to the Prophet Muhammad in the 7th century AD, the Sabians were able to win exemption from persecution at the hands of the Muslims by claiming not to be pagans, but a people of the book, distinguished like the Christians and Jews by their possession of a divinely revealed scripture. When asked to show their book, they produced a copy of the Hermetic texts, the Greek and Latin writings, purporting to be dialogues between Thoth, the Hermes of the Greeks, the Mercury of the Romans, and various of his pupils. It is noteworthy that Thoth, as well as being the god of wisdom, was also lord of the moon, and that the major temple of Harran was dedicated to the moon god of their own pantheon, whose name was Sin. Last but not least, Philo of Byblos tells us that Sanchuniathon, the source of his Phoenician history, carefully searched out the works of Tortos. He did this since he realized that Tortos was the first person under the sun who thought of the invention of writing, and who began to compose records, thereby laying the foundation, as it were, of learning. The Egyptians called him Thuth, and the Alexandrians Thoth, and the Greeks translated his name as Hermes. We stay a few hours longer in Byblos. Excavations of the ancient city lie all around the Crusader castle. There's a Roman colonnade, a small theatre, Phoenician ramparts, the remains, little more than foundations, of the temple of Balat Gebel, circa 2800 BC, and dedicated to the Phoenician patron goddess of Byblos, and the so-called L-shaped temple, circa 2600 BC. A sacred lake once separated the two edifices. On top of a podium, a number of small, crude obelisks still stand, the Temple of the Obelisks, circa 1900 to 1600 BC. There are the remains of the royal necropolis of the kings of Byblos, circa 18th century BC down to 10th century BC, but mingled in with all this, very close to it, is the Neolithic quarter, dating back to 5000 BC and beyond, where the inhabitants of Byblos first started to make floors of crushed limestone